was pleasantly surprised to note that you come from Hanover, Pennsylvania.
Do you?
Well, no, I don't, but I used to date a girl in Hanover. Her name was Jonquil Yingling.
How funny.
She was so cute.
With a name like Jonquil, she would have to be cute.
And she was very cute. I worked in New York for about 4 years. I was news director of the NBC affiliate in York. And I got to like York County a lot. The only thing that bothered me, I would have to drive Jonquil home late on a Saturday night, 3 o'clock in the morning, to Hanover, and come back home. And the roads weren't that perfected in the early 1960s, and I remember it was hard to stay awake. But Jonquil was worth it.
I'm glad to hear it.
How long did you live in Hanover?
Well, I was in Hanover, New York, till I was 11. And then we went down south. My mother was from the south, but my father was from York County.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting. I mean, I got a lot of good York County common sense, I think. But with all that southern flamboyance.
York County common sense.
I think people there, they tell you what is. They're sort of, they work hard. They keep their houses clean. They keep their streets clean. They're a very industrious group.
Yeah, I guess that Pennsylvania Dutch influence, huh?
I think so. And my father was a Dunkard, so we were right in the middle of it.
What was it like growing up in Hanover?
Well, I think when you're little, it's a lot different than when you're adult. All I did was go outside and play and go to school. And it was wonderful, but I suspect it would have been wonderful anywhere.
Growing up, you mean?
Yeah, out in the country. I mean, I just think country life is wonderful. I don't know what it's like growing up here as a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not so great.
Was your family literary?
No. Oh, no, not at all. Not in the least. I think Daddy went to 6th grade or maybe 8th. And Mother went to 10th. They were working people. Good bloodlines, but working people.
Well, how did these literary aspirations of yours develop coming from a non-literary family?
I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else. I mean, I don't know how you came to work in radio, but it was so clear I came out of the womb looking for the library.
Did you have a rather singular life as a child?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of kids in the house. I wasn't the only child in the house. But
well, that would drive a lot of kids to the library, being lonely. No, seriously, being lonely or being somewhat different from the other kids. And so they develop their own worlds.
I don't really was. I mean, I was always the leader of the pack, you know, the ones that got the others organized and the captains of the teams. And I just loved books. Didn't know there was any other way to be.
So you moved down to Florida when you were 11.
And, well, I don't even recognize it now. When we went there, Fort Lauderdale was about 30,000 people. There was a Catholic school, a private school, a black school, and then Fort Lauderdale High. And that was it. Teeny little town. It was like being in Georgia, really. It was like an outpost of Georgia. And from the time I started junior high school until I finished college, it had been completely taken over and turned into some giant neon mushroom.
Hmm. Where did you go to school?
Fort Lauderdale High.
No, college.
New York University, Washington Square College.
Uh-huh.
Right here.
What drove you to New York?
Best education in the world.
How so?
Well, NYU is a fabulous school. And I was mostly interested in English and classics. That was my double major. And they were just in the top 10, and I think the classics department at that time was actually number one. May still be. It's an excellent school. But I think private universities usually are of a certain level. And, of course, it's got the best law school in the United States and one of the best medical schools.
Well, Harvard, Yale might disagree.
They can disagree all they want. I'm going to stick by NYU.
No, I don't blame you. But wasn't it scary to come here? You grew up in Fort Lauderdale was small then, and certainly Hanover was small. Wasn't it kind of scary to embark on this new adventure in this big city?
I was too dumb to be scared. I just thought it was fabulous. You know, now I look back and think, how did I do it? But that's what youth is all about.
Yeah, taking chances, breaking new ground.
Not even knowing what the chances are.
exploring new places.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, yeah, youth is a process of exploration, isn't it?
Got you here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I came from the Midwest, and coming from a place called Wichita in Kansas, you look for other places for a career. Yeah, unless you want to work for a Piper Cub. And going to school in Ohio, you still look for other places. And, of course, being a broadcast journalist, there's not much of a better place than New York for that. So it was a very conscious decision. It takes a long time, though, for most people to try to get into New York. It's not that easy, really. You can come here as a dishwasher, but it's not easy to come here and work for NBC, ABC, or CBS.
I know.
It's tough.
I mean, obviously I didn't come at the level you did. I was just a kid going to college. I'm not even sure I could come to NBC, CBS, or ABC now, but it certainly would be exciting. I mean, I think you've got to have just an incredible job.
Who does?
You.
Oh, no. It's the interesting thing about the job is talking to people like you and talking to the great writers of our generation. If you can name a writer... I probably interviewed him or her over the last 10 or 15 years. But I have to do other things, too, and a lot of it is tedious work in the newsroom. I mean, I write headlines and report on stories that are dull and produce newscasts, and a lot of it is... In journalism, it's repetition. One fire is just like another fire. One election is like another election. All you have to do is fill in the blanks. So there's a great deal of tedium. I don't know if it's unlike writing a novel. There's a great deal of tedium in writing a novel. You have to flesh out scenes, fill in action, and create the dialogue. Even if you love what you're doing, there are a lot of structural things that take up time, and that's tedious, isn't it?
Not to me. It never seems tedious. But I just always go to the typewriter with a wing and a prayer and hope it's going to turn out all right. I think what's tedious for me is having to sit still, because I'm not by nature physically quiet. I like to be out doing things.
Well, I noticed in High Hearts there's a very nice picture of you with a horse in the background, so I know you're a horsey person.
Yeah.
And indeed the heroine of Bingo is obviously a horsey person. Now, this is indicative that you do care about the outdoors a lot, and action. Certain amount of physical activity. Let's go back, before we work our way up to Bingo, let's go back a little further and let's talk about your initial work. Your first book, which was a very explicit lesbian book. Tell me how that came about and why you wrote it.
Well, it wasn't my first book. It was my third, but it was my first novel.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to see if I could do a novel, and I sat down at the typewriter pretty much the way I always sit down at the typewriter. I have a character in mind, and then the character just takes off. It's what the Greeks said. I mean, Aeschylus said it long before I ever did. Character is fate. And so when I wrote Ruby Fruit Jungle, that turned out to be her fate. And I was actually pretty excited about the whole process and didn't know how it would be received. And it wasn't received at all. I mean, I went to every publisher in New York City, and they pretty much put me out on my ear. I was 27 at the time. And a little teeny publishing company that was 2 minutes old, that just started, a woman called June Arnold and her partner, Park Bowman, bought it for $1,000. And it sold 70,000 copies by word of mouth. So Bantam, being no fools, Bantam Books, said, we're going to buy this and re-release it. And in fact, they did.
You know, that's an interesting story. It also shows the lack of courage among publishers. They want something that's safe. It's easy for Bantam to step in then, after you and that little publishing house had the courage to publish this book. It's easy for Bantam to say, hey, that's a successful property. We ought to pick that up. This happens all the time. This is why it's very difficult for a good first novelist sometimes to be recognized. People won't even read their manuscripts.
No, it's true. Now, at that time, Bantam was a reprint house. Now, they do hardcover fiction. And now they've got a division for young writers starting out. And, you know, maybe they'll print 15 or 20,000 copies of a novel. White Palace is one of their books from that division, trying to develop the next generation of fiction. But fiction is always a risk. I mean, you're at much less risk if you're in Simon & Schuster or Random House and you do a book on the horrors of cellulite, you know. So to be a fiction editor in and of itself marks one as a special breed of cat. And even then, you have to have a fair amount of power inside that publishing house to be able to take the risk on a new writer, perhaps a different kind of theme. I mean, it was remarkable for centuries, black Americans have been writing, but you didn't see black American fiction until about 25 years ago. It took publishers that long to figure out they could publish it, and there was a market for it.
Or gay fiction.
True. That's another one.
And in fact, I was talking to Edmund White not too long ago. He had written a number of early novels which had been turned down, and some of them had been turned down by gay editors. And he said, why? I mean, I know you. You're gay. Why would you turn this down? He said, well, we can't stigmatize ourselves. It's an unpopular thing. We just can't do it. Now they can do it, and Edwin White's books reach a mainstream of all sorts of people. And they're wonderful, wonderful novels. He's a wonderful writer. But these early days, 20, 25, 30 years ago, could not sell these books.
Or as my mother said, honey, you couldn't get arrested.
Your nonfiction books, the two that preceded your first novel, what were they about?
They were poetry.
Ah.
And, I mean, that's really a hardy soul that will stick with poetry in America. Yeah. You know, in Russia, you can pack in a football stadium if you're a poet. But in America, you're lucky if you sell 5,000 copies. But most writers, I think, in the English language will start with poetry or journalism or both. The good thing about poetry is it forces you to be economical. You know, the wrong word can throw the whole thing off. And I was glad that I started there. I love poetry. I mean, I still read it, and I still write it. I just don't do anything with it. And I don't know what else to say except that I was lucky and they got published, and I had a little bit of a readership. And then I just knew, come on, it's time. Try a novel. Let's see if you can do it. Go to the big leagues.
Yeah, yeah. And writing a novel is a risk because of the inevitable difficulty in trying to sell it, especially two books of poetry behind you. It's a tough thing. But even established novelists have this uncertain feeling about, can I sell my second one? Can I sell my third? There's no guarantee. When I say established, that means published, I guess, rather than established. I guess established means something a little more, doesn't it, with a following.
Oh, I still get rejections. I think any writer does. I wanted to do a book on Jefferson. Very much I wanted to do a book on Thomas Jefferson. And my publisher just was quite disinterested in it. They were interested in what I wanted to do on the Madisons. But in my mind, the two books were tied together. And, of course, the research covers both groups of people, both families. And you know, it stings, but you reel back from it and you figure out, well, where can I go from here? We all get rejections. And also, some of us are better at some things than others. You know, some people can do novels, but they can't do screenplays. Some can do screenplays, they can't do novels. So you're always trying things, and some work and some don't, and you just go on.
Sounds like you can do about everything.
Not always. I try. I like teleplays and screenplays, and I have a facility for it. What's hard for me are magazine articles because it's such a small little compass that I have a hard time with it. Occasionally I'll do one, it'll work. Most often it won't.
Can't you take the Jefferson book someplace else? Does it have to go to Bantam?
Well, I'm very allied to that company on many levels, emotionally as well as a commitment for a certain number of novels. And I've been well served by Bantam. And also, I know them. I've been with them for 10 years, which I realize in publishing these days is an eternity. And I trust them very much. And so if we have a disagreement over one book, I'm not going to turn around and punish them and run somewhere else.
Well, that's not punishing them. Did you finish the book?
No, but I think I'll get around to it. I think sooner or later I'll slip it by them yet.
Yeah, I mean, you have no obligation to put that novel in a drawer if they are disinterested. In fact, I think you have an obligation to find a readership for it. And if that means that particular book goes away from Bantam to someone else, well, you ought to do it.
Yeah, but I'll always try to work things out with Bantam first because I really do love the people there. And I have an editor that most people would kill for.
Who's that?
A woman called Beverly Lewis. And, you know,
Lewis?
Lewis. Finding the right editor is like finding the right mate. And when you've got a really great editor that you're... you're just on the same wavelength, to use that old hackneyed phrase. Boy, I would hesitate long and hard before I'd walk away from Beverly. And, you know, she's another Southerner. She's easy for me to work with, and she can tell me where I go wrong in a way that, instead of offending me, makes me want to do better.
Yeah. Yeah, and a good editor with whom you are attuned can give an objective viewpoint toward a book in a way that the writer can't do. I guess you get so deeply into the text that it's hard to look at it objectively. It's like we have a one of our managers likes to dabble in on-the-air reporting here. And when he goes on the air, he can only visualize one story, his. If he weren't in that position and he stays back in his office, he can look at the overall programming that we do and make it's like an editor at the New York Times suddenly going out and becoming a correspondent. He can see the one story. He's putting his heart and his soul in there. And he can't see the overall, how it will appear on that page as positioned against another story that day. You can't look at the overall page of newspaper. And I think, in a way, writers are like that. They can only they see their characters, and they get consumed by their words. And it takes someone objective who doesn't have that emotional capital in the book to say, well, this is not quite working. And I would imagine your editor is that way.
She is, in fact. I mean, I look at the book, and it's like my baby. I'm irrationally in love with it, and I don't want anyone to harm it, you know. So you do need people to help you along the way. It's an interesting profession because the actual process of writing is quite solitary. Everything after that is communal. So you have to switch gears. You have to switch even more in film or television. Again, the first draft is very solitary. And after that, it's writing by committee. Fortunately, that's not what happens in publishing. It's not writing by committee. But you do wind up with a team, which is your publishing house and the publicity director and the president, of course, and all the people and the people in the telephone sales who have become like a family to you. They are a family to you. And that's sort of exciting, but you have to learn to step back. You know, when you're writing, it's all you and your ego's in it in a different way. And when you turn it over to the editor or when you turn the screenplay back to the producer, you have to let them take over in a way. So now you sit in the back seat.
Yeah, they don't want you around at this point.
Well, sometimes they really don't. And with some writers, I can well understand it because we don't lack for ego.
Well, it's obvious that you do fall in love with your characters. You are obviously delighted by them in Bingo. And the little town, the name of which escapes me.
Runnymede.
That's right, Runnymede. That has the Mason-Dixon line down, right down the center. And it must, I guess the Pennsylvania side must obviously be York County.
Well, yeah, somewhat. Sure, close enough.
Yeah. So it's very clever how you have created the little map, and as you wrote, you would refer to the Bonton department store, and indeed in York there was a Bonton department store right across from the radio station where I worked. And so often as you would make reference to places, I would flip back to the map, and I would pick these out. Well, tell me about Bingo. Now, this is a sequel to an earlier book called Six of One, right?
It is. I wrote Six of One 10 years ago. You can read Bingo without ever reading Six of One. It stands quite alone. But the characters in Six of One were so overpowering to me, I knew I had to come back. I never quite got them out of my head. And when I originally thought about Six of One, it was going to be a 1,000-page novel. And my editor at that time, a very lovely man, named Harvey Ginsberg, said, nobody's going to read a 1,000-page novel in America today. You better think about this book all over again. I did. The result was 601. But I knew there was more to the story, and I had to come back to it, which is what I did in Bingo. And it's funny you were saying I had delight in my characters. I do, but I think I have delight in people. And that sort of shows up often in the novels. I find people fascinating. I don't think there's any such thing as an ordinary person. It just doesn't exist. And, of course, in Bingo, none of them are ordinary. They fight and carry on like trash, as we say down south. But I've got to tell you this one thing, because it's so ludicrous. I had to go to Bingo parlors. I hadn't played Bingo since I was a little girl at the York Fair. And, you know, you played with corn. You put little pieces of kernels of corn on these Bingo cards. So I went to my first bingo game in order to be current and found out, number one, they don't use corn. They use these things called dab-a-dots. And number two, bingo is serious. It's real serious now, and people are playing for money. And so I learned a lot. I mean, there were people there that had computer brains. They'd have 15 bingo cards, and all I could do was sort of stumble through with one. But the game I played that unfortunately doesn't show up in bingo because it just didn't suit the story is I played Bessie Bingo. I know y'all don't do that here in New York City. But the Orange County Fair had to raise some money for a charity. And they had Bessie Bingo. So you had your bingo card and you sat around a pasture. And there were lime numbers on the pasture. And they brought out Bessie the cow. And wherever Bessie evacuated, that was your bingo number. I mean, it's so corny. It could only happen in America. Can you imagine people in the French countryside playing Bessie Bingo? But I sat there. Of course, I just played until the tears rolled down my eyes.
Well,
it was
they
so
do that
silly.
In New York City, only they do it with real people.
Okay. I think I'll pass on that bingo game.
It's a very funny book. And Nickel is a very sympathetic character, and I have a feeling Nickel is very much like yourself. Tell me about that character.
In some ways, she is. She's much more of a conforming character than I am, and much more detached than myself. But she has to be detached in order to tell the story, because her mother and her sister are such overpowering figures that you just couldn't have the narrator be that flamboyant. She works at a small-town newspaper that's being sold out from under her feet, which is just a life crisis. And she's watching her mother and her sister fight over a new man that's come to town. And these are elderly women, and they're behaving in a way that is hardly dignified. But then again, they rarely are anyway. So she's just astonished at what's happening. And then she gets herself in a terrible mess. She's involved in an immoral love affair. She just has no business being in it. So here's this poor soul trying to tell you what's going on in her town while her life is falling apart.
That's right, and the effort to raise the newspaper. She probably would have been very good buying that newspaper, but of course at the end we see that she lucks out at the end. You have made Nickel a lesbian. Isn't that taking a risk in creating a central character and identifying her as a lesbian?
Well, I don't think an artist is an artist unless they take a risk. You have to keep taking risks. And I don't think about it when I do it. I mean, the characters are such complete people to me, I don't ask questions about them. And I don't think about whether they're risky or not, because they're just real. And they have lives of their own. And I don't manipulate them. I think they wind up manipulating me.
Well, Nickel is certainly very sympathetic, and everybody likes her. But when I say taking a risk, there are people who are repelled by homosexuality and will say, well, look, I'm not going to read about this gay broad. I mean, to hell with it, I'll find a book that the character is more appealing to me. And in that respect, isn't it true, you could take a risk by having a character like that?
I guess you could, but you know, you're not responsible for how people use or misuse your work. All you can do is the best you're able to do and put it out there and see what happens. And I suspect that people that are narrow-minded are repelled by many things, not just a central character like Nickel.
You have a real knack for dialogue, and the book is just filled with dialogue. I can see a screenplay in this. It almost felt like a movie because of the dialogue, the very brisk, bright connection, words between people. Any chance?
I don't know. I really don't. My film agent can tell you better than I've been on the road for a month. I've hardly talked to this fella. But actually, I do screenplays. So when I think of a novel, I really think of it as that format. If I'd wanted to do bingo as a screenplay, I would have. Because I sell original ideas to Hollywood as screenplays or teleplays. This isn't to say that if somebody buys it, I won't be happy. I suppose I will. But that isn't how I thought of it. And as for the dialogue, I guess, I don't know, people have often told me that I have a gift for it. But I grew up with people who talked like that. So to me, it doesn't seem like anything special.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think of my limited time in York County. It seemed to me that most of the people were rather quiet. I don't know if that was the Pennsylvania Dutch influence, but they didn't seem to be particularly gregarious people. Although out in the hinterlands of York County, there were people who resembled Appalachian people. They had that funny hillbilly dialect. You know mm-hmm. what I'm talking about?
I do.
They played banjos. I mean, they were as though they had left the hills of West Virginia to settle out in the wilds of York County. Those people talked. But not the industrious York County businessmen, the people who ran the insurance companies and were lawyers and things like that. I mean, that was my feeling.
Well, my father's family, which is from York County, I can't say as they were great talkers, but my mother's family, which is from Maryland, I mean, the last thing to die on them is their mouth. They'll just never shut up. So obviously I listened more to my mother's family. I didn't have much choice. They were very flamboyant characters. But you know, those people that are insurance salesmen and lawyers, I'm not sure they're great talkers anywhere.
Yeah, they're not too interesting, really, are they? Well, I guess. Jack, in the book, is a lawyer, and he was kind of interesting.
I think people may be interesting, but they just may not share themselves. They may not be particularly extroverted. A lot of jobs demand that you cloak yourself in a kind of blandness in order to be taken seriously. I mean, who wants a banker that's a comedian? You know, we want our bankers dressed in sober, almost like vestments, almost like churchmen, because money's so serious to us. So we want a certain kind of personality to whom we entrust our money. I think the same is true of lawyers and insurance salesmen, that oftentimes the job that people take on protective camouflage in order to survive in their jobs. But then underneath it, I would suspect they're just as interesting as my mom or sister or the guys that went in the Marine Corps from that family.
Doctors, too. I hate to run across a doctor who is kind of like a nut, you know. You want him to be really up there, you know, so you put all your confidence in the doctor. In one of the publicity pieces in that Bantam set over, there was an interview with you, and it dealt a lot with your feeling that people should be more assertive and dealing with lesbianism, which, of course, you've written about for a long time. And obviously, you've had no fear about making such assertions. Tell me a little bit about how you feel about that.
Well, I don't think about anybody making assertions, but I do think about them telling the truth. If people don't tell the truth about their lives, whatever their life is, how can you build a community? Because a community is based on trust. So that when you have one whole group of people who are withholding themselves for fear of punishment, and I think that there's a fair amount of realism in their fear of punishment, I think you weaken the community as a whole. And I'm a person who believes strongly in communities, and I know that may seem absurd in a city as large as New York, but where I live, it's a small town, and we really do need to know one another because we work cheek by jowl, and you see the same people every day. And if somebody's lying to you, it can hurt you, it can hurt everybody else that you're involved with in perhaps a business deal or just your social life. And in our society, we're encouraged to lie, whether we're straight or gay. I don't think by virtue of being a heterosexual, it makes somebody's life all that easy either. People are supposed to be monogamous, and they aren't. They lie about it because it's painful, hurts them, hurts other people, and yet they're tempted. And all of these barriers that we put around ourselves just means nobody ever gets to know us, the bad parts as well as the good.
Well, lying is one thing, but flaunting what you are is something else. I'm not suggesting that you are flaunting what you are, or that I'm flaunting, or any of us. I mean, I'm speaking only in generalities. But why bother to tell about all of the personal things in our lives that may be unpleasant or unhappy or might be disconcerting to others? Why bother? I mean, why can't the art speak for itself?
Well, I think art does speak for itself, but we were talking about people. And I think you do have to bother. I think you have to bother a lot with other people and try to connect with them on whatever level that you can. It's important. Life is tough, and you need a lot of friends in order to get through it. And if you're lying to your friends, you aren't going to have any eventually. And I don't know about flaunting. I think there are personalities that are very extroverted and need a lot of attention. I guess those people would flaunt whatever it is they are, whether it's a rock star or somebody running down the street carrying a sign. I don't even mind that so much, I guess. What the hell? It relieves the boredom.
What's going to happen to Nicole and Pierre, formerly Mr. Pierre? Are they going to become straight at some point in their lives? It looks like they were moving closer and closer. Pierre begins to look more manly, and Nicole looks more feminine. Of course, you always look feminine, but they just seem to be closer and closer in a physical way.
Well, he's an interesting character, and I loved him very much in the book. He's a hairdresser, Mr. Pierre. Now, I don't think they'll ever be lovers, but he was one of those, that generation of men for whom they knew they were going to get beaten up because they were gay. They knew life wasn't going to be easy, so he became extremely flamboyant. In other words, he hits you in the face before you hit her. You hit him, I mean. And I think a lot of people made that choice that are now in their 50s and their 60s. They became queens, and they're very amusing. But it's a defense mechanism. I think it's a defense mechanism. You may get somebody on your show that says the exact opposite. And once he had a home, a real home, he didn't have to do that anymore. He came home and somebody loved him. And no, it wasn't love like a husband and wife has, but somebody really loved him for himself. And he was responsible for children. And that allowed him to relax. I mean, he's always going to be gay. He's just going to be relaxed about it. He's not going to have to make those strong statements.
Well, Rita Mae Brown, to kind of wrap things up, just a final question or so. What took you to Charlottesville?
Well, my father's family is from there originally. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the most beautiful place in America. Not that I'm prejudiced, mind you.
I was going to ask what it's like. You must bump into Ann Beattie. She lives there.
She does, in fact. And Jack Kluge lives there. Jack Kluge and his wife, and Edgar Bronfman and his wife, and Sissy Spacek, and Jack Fisk, and Jessica Lange, and Sam Shepard, and Muhammad Ali's in the next county. We just got a mess
of
folks.
What did he write?
Not much, but he wrote all over other people's faces. Never forget that. I mean, there are people that are literally rearranged because of Muhammad Ali. It's a terribly exciting community, and it's a community with standards. There's a standard of behavior to which you're held. And if you don't meet that standard of behavior, you aren't really going to get along with folks too well. And you can't buy your way in, which is another thing I love about Charlottesville. Character counts a lot more than money. Money will buy you a lot of friendships with merchants, but it won't buy you friendships in the town, which is, of course, the complete reverse of Los Angeles, where money can buy you anything. And I love that about Charlottesville.
It's also very handy for a writer. You have the university and the library there. Isn't that true?
Oh, that Alderman Library is so terrific. It's a Federal Deposits Library. So if you can't find it at Alderman, you go up the road to the Library of Congress and you'll find it there. So it's perfect for a writer.
Yeah. Just to the final question, how do you work as a writer? Do you, in other words, do you carefully plan what you're going to be doing, or do you sit there and kind of work on the basis of inspiration, or what? How's it work?
Well, I usually know what I'm going to be writing in 10-year increments. I know the characters, but I don't know what's going to happen. So when a character is ready, I sit down to the typewriter, and as that old expression goes, I open a vein.
Bingo. It's a very funny book and very moving in places, and I think your readers are going to like it, and I hope it will bring more readers for you. Rita Mae Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.